Hello and welcome to episode 52 of Freedom to Fail. This week, I'm super excited to bring you an interview that I did with Brent Beck. He is the creator of games such as Cover Your Assets or Skull King or many others underneath his company, which is called Grandpa Beck's Games. So this was an awesome interview that I did with him. And I also just wanted to give a quick plug for him because he was kind enough to give a coupon code for all of the listeners out there. If you guys want to give any Grandpa Beck's games for Christmas, for the holiday season, or anything like that, then he has given a coupon code that you can use on Amazon or on his website, grandpabecksgames.com, to be able to get 15% off of any of his games. That coupon code is free2fail, free2fail, and you can use that on both his Amazon store, which you can just search Grandpa Beck's Games, or else on the website, grandpabecksgames.com. So again, 15% off. The games are awesome. I have all of them. We play them all the time with my family. So that's just a quick plug if you guys want 15% off for the holiday season. And this code is valid until November 24th. So take advantage now. Get all of your shopping done early. And while you're at it, go ahead and listen to this episode with Grandpa Beck.
When I was getting ready to propose, I actually proposed during a Scrabble game with my wife's parents and her playing together. I'd rig the tile so I could pull out the words, marry me, and I proposed by putting those letters out on the tiles. I never knew that we'd end up making games, but I used a game as a way to propose.
What is up, everyone? I'm Kyle, and I am the host and founder of the Freedom to Fail podcast and Fail Nation, a community where failing while pursuing our dreams is a positive and taking uncertain chances is celebrated. This podcast is for those who have a dream of starting a business or doing something they've always dreamed of, but have been held back by their fears. Our purpose is to share the unsuccessful stories of successful people so that you can learn how to take the first steps towards achieving your dreams. You deserve to live a life full of freedom and free of fear. Let's do this. All right, so I am sitting here today talking to Brent Beck from Grandpa Beck's Games. How are you doing, Brent?
Doing great. Thanks, Kyle.
Good. Yeah. Thank you for taking the time to join us and talk a little bit about your story. I know that it has been a bit of a wild ride for you. So for our listeners, talk a little bit about Grandpa Beck's Games. For a little bit of context, you guys have made games like Skull King, Cover Your Assets is probably the most well-known one. That's the one that I've known and played the most probably. And then you guys have a lot of other games too. So very popular, successful games that are out there, but tell us a little bit about how you got into the game business and what you guys are doing at Grandpa Beck's.
Well, it was a long story about how we began and one that is not probably typical in some ways, but maybe typical because everybody has things change as they come along. But about 15 years ago, we had the idea to take a game we modified from a face card game and make it a game, but I had no idea how to get it started, what to do, and it took us a number of years to get something ready to go to market, and it took us many years once we had things to sell to get things to where they're profitable, but we were persistent, and we can go into more details about how this happened, but we were persistent, and we were blessed because we have some really catchy games, and we have a great artist that helps us out, and somehow through all those difficulties, which we might go through more later, we've gotten to be where we have 7 games currently that are in our line. In July, we passed our first 1 million games sold, and we sold about 300,000 games, or 350,000 when you count the ones licensed out in the last year in 2020. And we now have inquiries and things starting all over the world for more sales and more growth. And we have a lot of things that have been difficult to get going, like design, production, distribution, that are now falling into place, and we're at a point where we're really going worldwide in many ways in the future.
Cool. What was the first game that you started working on?
The game we first started working on was a game we called Golf, which we no longer have in the line. Our first designer was a guy that had a game that was he'd created. He knew my wife's father knew him, and so we hired him to do the artwork for a game and then to design it. And this was the first game that we released. It was very creative as far as the packaging. And
it's called Flip 9 for those of you who don't see it.
That's right. It was going to be called Flip 9. But when we applied for this name, One of the main challenges we had was the trademark issues, and the trademark office said that Flip 9 was too close to some other game that was trademarked called Flip 5 or something, and so we were denied the trademark on this game, which is a whole story about the naming of the company and the name of the games, which I can go into as far as the trademark issues, which was a big part of our stumbling block. And there's also this design, though it was cute, it was kind of unstable because it was tall and big, expensive to store, and the first print run we did of this was totally defective. The cards were all splotchy and such. So we had to ditch the whole print run of it. But that was the first attempt. And then the second attempt was golf in a more concise size package. We changed out the box twice before we actually sold it because of a branding attempt with our second game, which was Cover Your Assets. And we presented them both together in 2012 at Toy Fair in New York, which is held at the Javits Center in Manhattan. We went there with the two games and went out to the world and said, oh, here we are selling Grandpa Beck's games with these two games. And that place is like six football fields or something in size, and there's just millions of stuff there. And we were kind of intimidated that we showed up with our two little games, but we made connections there that have been with us since, even though that show was not profitable. Connections over time from there have paid off over the years. But that was the beginning where we first actually had something on the market. That was 2012, but we actually started the company in 2008. So it took us a long time to get something actually ready to put on the market.
Wow. So that is 4 years for production and for just design and making sure that everything goes well. What were the things that took up the most time in that period before launch?
The first part was just finding some way to illustrate it. And the guy we finally found was had a game he had made that was very successful, and he had a line of games. He was selling his own games, plus he was selling some games from other people, and so he had distribution that was going on. The way the plan initially was that we were just going to have him do the artwork, that he was going to sell our game along with his game and his games, and that was going to be it. It was just going to be turnkey. Seemed easy. We paid him for his time, then he was going to sell our stuff. But then he had these two partners, which were controlled more than half of the company. And when things slowed down after the Christmas season, they didn't want to keep paying him. And they had a big fight and kind of destroyed his business. And he kind of dropped out of availability to market our product. So we had a game and no way to sell it. And it started a whole new process of trying to figure out how to go from there. So that was the first part. Then by 2012, we finally had got a second game, rebranded the whole thing, changed the trademark from it was going to be first called Funtime Games, but that was denied by the trademark office as well. Then it was going to be called Grampy's Games because I had a granddaughter who used to call me Grampy, who's at the time she was a little kid, now she's 16. And then when that was denied, actually it was approved and contested by someone who had a Grampy's golf tournament in Florida who had fancy lawyers in Connecticut that were going to sue us. And so the third attempt, our attorney for trademarks said, if you make it personalized, then they can't deny a trademark. So we changed it to Grandpa Beck's Games because that was something they couldn't deny. In the end, even though those other things were challenging and difficult with losing the trademark opportunities on those first two names, the fact that we eventually went to Grandpa Beck's Games was the best thing in the end because that gave us a company name that was much more personal. We started to initially brand the games with my little picture on the top with different hats, and we had the idea of putting my phone number in all the boxes so we could be more personal because it's Grandpa Beck's Games. And in the end, that kind of personal approach is really what helped us to have the branding we enjoy and the connection we have with families, because it's no longer just ABC Games. It's Grandpa Beck. I can call him on the phone. I can text him. I can watch a video of him talking about it. And so it made it really family oriented. And that was really one of the things that helps us to stand out, I think.
Yeah. And that reminds me a lot of one of our past guests. Her name is Jenna, and she runs a little ice cream shop actually here called Max A La Mode. They're basically macaron ice cream sandwiches, and they're delicious. And if you're in Orem, just a plug for them, you should go check them out because they're great. But she talked a lot about how when she first got started, she wasn't having a ton of success of marketing or getting the name out. And then she had a friend who owned a business who mentioned to her that you should start being the face of your business. You should go live on Instagram. You should take lots of behind the scenes pictures and do all these things.
And once she started doing that, then that is when her business really started to grow, because she started being a lot more personal. And it's like you mentioned, customers love that feeling of buying into a story of helping someone versus this faceless corporation that just takes our money and wants to make a profit. Nobody likes to support that. But when it's somebody personal, somebody that you can even tell yourself, even if you don't know them personally, like, oh, I feel connection to this person because they have provided me with this game, with this ice cream or whatever it is, it makes them a lot more willing to purchase the product. So I think that, like you mentioned, that was a very smart decision on your guys' part.
We kind of fell into it, but in reality, it really represents the, it actually should be called Grandpa Beck's Family Games, but it would be more accurate, because I had the audacity and the idea to start, but in reality, without my wife being supportive and being really good at coming up with game ideas and being a really good collaborator with our artists and being patient with the amount of hours that I spent away from doing more fun things, because for years we've spent most of our vacation times going to conventions and shows and things. And for a number of years, I was spending a couple grand a month to make the business keep going. So it made me feel poorer than I would have been if I hadn't been doing the business. And a lot of times I'd be sitting in a desk doing stuff instead of doing stuff that I would have been more fun with the family, especially during the school day or whatever when I was home, and also on layovers when I was an airline pilot. So all those things were challenges. And without our artist, if I hadn't found our second artist, we wouldn't have been successful anyway, because she really is the secret sauce that has helped us. Because traditionally, our games are more in the traditional kind of game in the past, where something like Phase 10 or whatever would be, where it's an interactive card game. But instead of just colors and numbers, with April being our artist, she gives us a real rich illustrative presentation to our games. And that has really been the whole difference, because the game's no longer just colors and numbers. They're really enjoyable to play, and they have a enough theme to make them where there's a story involved in the concept instead of just a mechanic.
Yeah.
So she really has been a key to our success, and she was very patient in the early days to kind of work us between projects and give us an affordable rate. But because of her contribution and continued contribution over the last 10 years or 11 since she started working with us, we really have a much richer brand, and we wouldn't be successful without that.
Yeah, and I mean, it just goes to show that storytelling is king. And even when it comes to games, that is what really draws people's attention. Like, you have a game called Skull King, and I'm just sitting here looking behind you. There's a picture of you dressed up as a pirate with your wife. And it is just like playing that game. I went to Lake Powell this summer with some of my best friends, and one of them brought it. That was the first time I had ever played it, but it was so fun. And the cards were just beautifully designed, and all the different characters involved it was a piece of art, and it made me really enjoy playing it. And even when it wasn't my turn, I still found myself looking at the box, looking at the cards, because it was a really interactive experience. So that is something very valuable that I think you guys have done really, really well. And yeah, I didn't know that you had an outside artist or designer, but she has been knocking out of the park for sure.
She wasn't born into our family, but now she's one of the family, and she's a shareholder in the company. And I met her when she was first a young married couple moving into our area in Seattle for a short time before they moved back to their home in Reno, where they were from. And she had moved before we needed her help. But then I remembered, well, April's an artist. We should check with her. And she's gifted, but very flexible, because she's done such a wide range of art in our games. Everything from cute dogs and Nuts About Mutts to a really crazy imaginative creatures in Cover Your Kingdom that are filled with hundreds of interesting art things and very detailed antiquities in our game Antiquity Quest and treasures. She has such a range. And in the Skull King game, when we were starting to work on the cards, we go, let's see, there's five pirates and there's two special pirates. We need seven faces for these games. We go, we've got seven faces, my wife and I and our five kids. So the seven main cards in the game are illustrations of our family members. And like the two mermaids are a daughter-in-law, and one of them is our artist, April. She's illustrated herself as one of the mermaids. So we've had a lot of fun with building in little family secrets into the cards. And if you look at the map card in the game, the X on the map card is where our house is on Kamano Island.
There you go. That's awesome. Yeah, very much, very personalized to you guys. So I think that's really cool. I want to talk a little bit about your life before this, because did you say you're 65 now?
Just turned 65 over Labor Day weekend this month.
Happy birthday. That's exciting.
Thank you.
But that means that you started this business, I mean, you said about 15 years ago with the designs and everything first off. So you were about 50. What were you doing before you transitioned to making games?
Well, my big dream in life, as far as a career goal, was to be an airline pilot. I grew up with no connections to anybody who flew, no, except I lived near an airport. I lived near SeaTac Airport, so I had planes flying overhead all the time. I figured, someone's got to fly those planes. Maybe I could do it. But it was really difficult to consider the possibility of how to do it. I didn't want to go in the military for various reasons. And so I had to wait until I was about 22 and I'd done some volunteer work for a couple of years. And then I spent a year working in the shipyards and finally had some money saved up. And that gave me the idea that maybe I could do this. Maybe I could pursue my dream to be a pilot. So I went to the local flight school in Seattle and started college at a community college. And I would go to community college in the morning, flight school in the afternoon, and work from 4 till midnight. And I did that for a year and a half to get all my ratings and be able to pay for them. And then just spent 10 years flying small planes, float planes, freight planes, commuter planes, all kinds of things until I got hired by Alaska Airlines 10 years later. And then spent 33 years for Alaska Airlines as a pilot, the last 25 years as a captain on first the MD-80, then the 737. About 28,000 hours of flying and lots of interesting things over the years. It was a great career that I loved and felt very honored to be able to do and to carry millions of passengers around the country and across the oceans. And funnest part of the career was my oldest son, who's also named Brent. He is also an Alaska Airlines pilot now. And we got to spend the last couple of years before I retired with he as my co-pilot. And we got to be Captain Brent Beck and First Officer Brent Beck flying passengers around. And that's a really rare opportunity to get not only get a family member in the cockpit, but to have that professional relationship flying together. So that was really cool.
That is super cool. I don't think I've ever heard of anybody being able to do that with someone who also flies in their family. So that's a very rare experience.
Yeah, there's others who had family members in the business, but nobody else shared the same name. So when it showed up in the crew orders with the two names the same, the gate agents were oftentimes apologetic because crew scheduling messed up and we're short one pilot. But in the end, they found out that there was actually two of us, not just one.
Yeah, I can imagine them probably being super stressed out in the moment whenever that happened. So now I'm curious, how did you make that transition from being a pilot to now creating games and having a game business?
Well, I certainly had no training in it. To be a pilot, you had to have a degree back then. So I got a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology because that was easy to get while I was working full-time and going to school part-time. My wife's a retired hairdresser with no college officially. Running budgets and financial things is not my forte. And so it wasn't because of any financial acumen of mine. But pilots have kind of a varied schedule and we're all kind of a little bit organizers or whatever as a pilot mentality, perhaps. And over the years, I'd looked at different kinds of things as a side job, just, you know, because we all want to do better and do more. But I never could really buy into any kind of the direct marketing things that came along because I didn't think they were providing a value that was fair for the product that was being sold. And I did a couple of real estate things. I built a spec house and sold it. I had a house that was a lease back option and I remodeled that and sold it. But that was right before the 2008 financial, whenever that was, the 2008 financial crisis. And so I didn't really want to go into real estate at the time because it seemed risky. I just barely got these houses sold before the market dropped 40%. I was lucky that I wasn't holding them still. I could have come back fine, but I had sold them and it was out of that. So because of my kids at the time, I'd taken a big pay cut with the airlines about the same time because of that setback in this economy. I took like a 40% pay cut with the airline and all the airlines were losing pensions and people were getting laid off. And I had a pension in the potential, but was I really going to get that or not? And so that's what made me motivated. Plus at that time, my kids were just hitting the college years and the weddings and those expensive years for a parent to help the kids through those things. And so the game idea came out of necessity of thinking of something to do to try and make up for this this loss that I had financially and to try and have a better option to help the kids with their educations and such.
I think I remember reading that you guys really got started or really enjoyed loving games when you were a young married couple because you didn't really have much money. And so you would have game nights where you would invite your neighbors over and that would be your way to socialize, where the kids would go watch a movie and you guys would sit down and play games and it just kind of blossomed from there, right? Is that right?
Certainly, that's all true. And the little fun twist before that is 40 plus years ago, we had a 40th wedding anniversary as well on my 65th birthday. But when I was getting ready to propose 6 months before that, 40 plus years ago, I actually proposed during a Scrabble game with my wife's parents and her playing together. I had rigged the tile so I could pull out the words, marry me, and I proposed by putting those letters out on the tiles. And so that was a thing I never knew that we'd end up doing, making games, but I used a game as a way to propose, which is kind of funny. But we definitely did that. We played a lot of fun games with our, you know, traditional games with our friends, and we played a lot of card games. I always loved card games. And we oftentimes modified them to make a traditional card game more interesting. And so we had that history of card games with friends and family, and also with making them different than they were designed. Because that was, we had a game we called Killer Uno, which had about 20 extra rules on it, which was a little bit over the top. Hard to remember who was doing what. It was something that came back when we decided we wanted to make the games.
Yeah, I love games. Games is something that is super important for my family. We always get together, usually have Sunday dinner together, and then we'll always play games Sunday nights just because it helps us feel really connected. And I'm not a big strategy game person. I like the games that are pretty quick. And I feel like I'm not alone in that aspect. There are definitely people who love strategy games and love playing for hours and hours and hours, but that is not me. So that's why I like your games, because they're pretty quick and easy to get through with a family.
Yeah, we certainly are not in the big Euro game, building a civilization, planning for hours in your game world. But that's because I prefer a game that's more about interaction and more about the relationships and the fun time being had. And the game is a vehicle towards those achievements of family connections. Nothing wrong with big games, but if you have a game that's too complicated, then it take the whole evening to learn it. You haven't had a chance to really just have fun. And our games all play in rounds. So if you have, you know, 15 minutes, you can play a few rounds. If you have a whole evening, people will play them over and over again. But we like the fact that it's not so hard. And just personally, I work hard in life. I don't want to work that hard when I'm playing a game. I want to just have fun.
Amen to that. So out of all the games that you've created now, what would you say is your favorite?
Well, you're kind of asking like my favorite child.
Exactly.
You know, it's kind of hard to identify. So it's a tough question. But I like them for different reasons. But in reality, when I say, okay, we've got a game night available, we've got time to have just fun playing a game, I usually default to Skull King, because it is the one that I probably have played recreationally the most. I could go on about reasons why I love them all, and they all were developed with a lot of family background and love to them. But Skull King is definitely a favorite, and it's a fun, fresh challenge every time, even though it's something I played hundreds of times. It's just
those are the best kind of games, the ones that you can pull them out and you just play over and over and over again. So I want to talk about some of the failures and some of the hard times that have gone with going with building this business, obviously, because first off, you've already said you didn't have any experience in business in general, let alone in the card game industry. But first off, I want to touch on something that you had said previously when you were talking about building the business and how there were years where you were having to spend your own money month after month just to keep the lights on, so to speak, in the business and keep it around, and how family vacations would come, but it would really just be more work and you felt like you were separated from your family and you weren't as present as you would like to be. How did you feel in those moments?
We did find time for some family outings, but with my wife and I, a lot of time we would have used for extra fun trips were usually involved with a game show. But we did have a lot of fun with the family. Luckily, by the time we started the business, my kids were mostly all out of high school. So really, that was a key for our personal sanity. It was that the kids were all adults pretty much before we started. So I didn't have to feel like I had to miss out on the kids raising too much, which I think was important, because if I'd had to do all this and I was taking my time away from the scout outings or different things, that would have been worse. But the whole thing, I was just so naive about the whole thing, because we had this simple plan. This guy was going to make the game. He was going to sell it. And my wife says, I never believed that plan, but I believed it. You know, I thought that was the way it was going to work out. And so that was the plan. I never really intended to go to trade shows and stuff. That's, you know, it's such an amount of work and hassle. I never really wanted to do that. I didn't want to have to go and hawk my own game and trying to get people to buy it. That was not my plan. But once I got started, I couldn't go back, you know? That's kind of the way it is for me in life. I launch into something like being an airline pilot. I don't really know how to do it, how it's going to work out. But once I get started, I have to stick with it, you know, and I'm not going to stop. And so with the game business, even though we started off with a rocky start with a designer that failed to stay with us and the design that was not functional for stores and the names that got squelched by trademarks and the remakes we had to make to be able to get the game ready for market and all those expenses that happened before we even started selling something, those were really tough things. And I'd taken out some home equity to be able to start off initially. And in 2012, when we first got the order of games, we had four stacks, floor to ceiling in one bay of the garage which was our warehouse, you know, and so we started off in the garage like a lot of businesses would. And then, like I say, every time I was on a layover, instead of going out and enjoying walking around the city or whatever, I would be sitting in my hotel room calling people on the phone and working on things and spending a couple grand a month instead of making money. There was a lot of sleepless nights and difficult times, but we persisted and really just stuck with it. We'd go to both shows for retailers and also retail shows several times a year to try and get things started, try and make something happen, and just beat the bushes and called with people and did what we had to get something going. Because in the end, with a game, the really successful way to have it be shared is word of mouth. A game is something you play with other people, not yourself. And so that's really our secret success, that people share with their friends as a result of them just playing it, not in an overt effort, but just as a nature of the product, they share it. And that gradually get the word spreading around the U.S. and around the world as it happens. And we do a lot of other promotional things, but that's really the thing that has been the most successful for us. But it wasn't easy, and it takes a long time to get that going. And
definitely,
I'd be at Toy Fair and I'd say, we have this game I'm trying to explain, but people might have a new toy or a ball and they can look at it in 2 seconds, we'll know what it is. They go, it'd be so much easier to describe that new little toy. A game is like just a box until you play it. So it's a difficult thing to get started, but it has a good long-term upside, but it's not an easy product to get going.
Yeah, I can only imagine all of the education that goes into selling games to the customers to get them interested must be overwhelming. I want to go back to what you had mentioned just barely, and you had mentioned it earlier too, how there were months where you spent thousands of dollars instead of earning any money. How many months do you think that was that you had to spend your own money instead of make money?
It was probably it started off 4 years before we began making any money. Of course, I was spending money. And then for the first 5 years, probably of the business after 2012, it was probably a deficit spending situation. At the time, I'd be making some money, but not making as much as we were spending. Because when you go into business, there's a lot of ways to spend money. Everybody wants to sell you a service or a product or charge you for this or that. That part is easy, spending the money. But getting to where you're making more than you're earning is difficult. And if I hadn't already had a good career, where I had a really good career as an airline captain, I wouldn't have the money to do it. Plus, as a pilot, you have kind of a flexible schedule. You can change your schedule around and block out time when you don't have to work every day. You work here and there, and you can kind of work hard for a couple weeks and take some time off when it's not vacation time. And plus, I had kind of the audacity, because if everything failed, I could have my pension, which would still be more than like my dad had as a school teacher. And so I figured, okay, if I don't succeed, then I can always survive on this pension. And I kind of didn't put my money into a 401k and stuff during those years I was building the business, because I was putting it all in the business. So I kind of risked my retirement one way or the other. Either I was going to be more successful by the business succeeding, or I was going to be living a more humble situation and retiree if the business didn't succeed and I had to survive off of just my pension. I'm lucky that it went the second way, or as far as being successful, and instead of the way it could have gone very easily, where I would have blown my retirement.
So in those moments or in those months where you were spending money, I'm just thinking from my personal experience, if that were me, I would imagine, well, I know that if that were me and if I were in your shoes, I would feel a little bit insecure about myself and as a provider, just because I deal with issues with self-confidence a lot and with feeling like I'm enough or doing enough for those around me. Did any of those feelings creep into your mind?
There's no doubt that I had many sleepless nights because of difficulties. And it's been a big stress in life as far as making sure that we're going to be secure, you know, as far as to not, you know, be a burden to the family or whatever when you get older. And I had the pension, so it was something. But because of some of those fears of if I'm going to be able to make enough, it kept me from being maybe as willing to invest in stock market stuff as I might have otherwise, because I was afraid of losing something there too. And I'd invested in a couple startups that friends of mine brought to me earlier in my married life. And both of those totally went bankrupt. I never got out of the box. And so I lost tens of thousands of dollars in other people's startups, which again, kind of jilted my perspective on investing, because these were not the kind of investments I should have been doing. I should have done just conservative, normal, you know, mutual fund or something. But I tried the couple things I thought were going to be great, and they both busted. And with this business, my wife and I figured, okay, in the other businesses, we were counting on someone else to succeed. In this case, we can decide on whether we're going to succeed or not. We don't really have a choice on how it's going to be received, but we can decide to work hard. We can decide not to give up, and we can decide to use all of our energies to do it. So we had that choice. We still could have been unsuccessful, because, you know, there's no guarantees. It's because you're dedicated and you work hard that you're going to succeed. But we had good products and we were dedicated and we're patient and we're willing to suffer through sometimes. But in the end, we're blessed because the products were received well by consumers and we made a connection with people. But it was definitely not the easy path. You know, it would have been much easier just to invest in a 401k and just live simply and not put every extra minute into something else. Because I'm never off work because even now, my phone number is in more than a million boxes. So people call me all the time and send me messages. And so I'm never not working. Even if I'm on a cruise or something, I'm still answering the phone, you know. So it's a choice, but it's an interesting life experience. I enjoy every interaction I have, but it's not the easy path.
For sure. I like that mindset that you brought up because I feel like that's one that I find over and over again when I talk to successful entrepreneurs or just successful people in life in general. And it's the decision, the conscious decision to take responsibility and to take back the control. Instead of waiting and hoping that somebody else either does well, like an investment, or instead of waiting and hoping that somebody else likes our product, just any other thing, waiting for that external validation, you tell yourself, hey, it doesn't matter how this is received. I can't control that. Like what I can control is my efforts and my hard work. I can control how much time I spend in developing a better product. So obviously I want to hear that feedback, but whether or not somebody likes me or likes my product or my business, that doesn't say anything about me. And I've found that for me, when I've been successful in life or those periods where I've felt more confident and successful have been the times where I've really focused on what I'm doing versus how it's being perceived by other people or being received in the business world. And that's the only way to have success. So I think that that's a super, super smart and obviously logical way to go about living life and running a business too.
Certainly been persistent and we're willing to not be perfect out of the box because like our current edition of Skull King is actually the fourth edition. And we each time we have done the games, we've updated things and improved things and it's never quite done. I figured we'd make the one game and be done, but we're never done with game development because we're always striving to improve our products. And we spent the last year and a half going through a whole refresh of the whole line to get them all consistently branded because initially we didn't have a graphic artist. We just had our illustrator. And so we brought in a new team member to help us to go through and refresh all the games. And it was quite a difficult process, but now they're getting ready for wider retail acceptance and more international distribution. So we wanted to make them their best we could.
Let's talk about that for a second with the growth of the business. I'm just curious where you see yourselves going in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Well, it's an interesting thing. When I first started, my goal was to someday get to 2 million in sales and not have employees. But we have employees now and we had 3.5 million in sales last year. But we feel now we're just in the beginning of our potential. My perspective on what can happen has changed. And I see that we are just at the beginning of a tipping point that has a huge unlimited potential because we didn't have any salespeople until this year. This spring, we hired 2 salespeople to work full time. One works more in the game business, one more in the toy and book business. And so they go with us to the appropriate trade show based on which market area we're marketing. And they both bring so many additional skills to the table and backgrounds that are really helping us out in so many ways that they weren't even hired for, just adding new skills because they're in the team. So that is a big thing. And we're just now, just after 10 years, we're just getting finally into wider retail. We purposely didn't go into mass retail initially because we wanted to make sure that they would succeed when that happened. And we didn't want to have that happen too soon. We also wanted to make sure we could fund it ourselves without having to go to partners or whatever. So we've been able to kind of just grow our capability with our ability. So we didn't have to ever get to the point where we had to sell off part of the company to get a backer or something. So we didn't do that. And so the combination of those things, plus the fact that we're into some mass stores and we will hopefully be in like major mass stores in the coming years. And we have some international distribution, but we have inquiries from all over the world with companies. Skull King is printed in Korean and Japanese and through a licensing agreement in EU languages. But I have a new agreement starting in China and in Argentina and Brazil and Poland. And I mean, we have products that we are confident will grow around the world and be on the market for decades. The game Pit was made like 102 years ago and people are still playing it. And we hope that way after we're gone, people are still enjoying our games. And so, you know, we're blessed to be in a position where we have all kinds of opportunities and we see no, I'm 65, but I'm not.
You're not slowing down by any means.
With our team that we have and with the inquiries we have and the opportunities we have and we have a super great relationship with a production facility in Krakow, Poland, that really goes to bat for us and does a good job. And we have a great warehouse in Chicago that can handle anything for us that we have to do as a part of a worldwide corporation. So we have all the tools in place for unlimited growth in the future. And because we're just at the beginning of going into wider markets. We're really well known in a few states like in Idaho and Utah, but that's really a small percentage of the country population. And we are not very well known in most of the country. So, and most of the world, we have distribution begun in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, UK, other places, but just very, very fledgling efforts there. So who knows? I'm just focused on making it happen.
I think you're going to. Obviously, you guys have been able to see really great growth. But one thing about your story that sticks out is the fact that it is a slow process to find success a lot of times. Too often, I feel like entrepreneurs look for that success within a year, within 2 years. And if they're not having success, then like that quickly, then they think that they're a failure or that the business idea isn't viable. But what I've found is that from talking to a lot of other people, and just from my own experience, it really takes about 5+ years to know if your business is going to actually be really successful or not. With my window cleaning company, for example, this is year 6. And so last year was the first year where I was not quite stressed out about money. And we finally had stabilized and we were able to grow a little bit and feel like, oh, this is something that actually can stay around and be viable. And I've found that by talking to so many different business owners too. It takes a long time to be able to not only establish success for that year, but also build that reliability that your business is going to be around for years to come too. So I think it's a great story of persistence, like you said.
Yeah, we were talking to a owner of the company that makes the set game years ago. And she says, you know, it takes 10 years to become an overnight success. And that was her phrase that she used. And that really, it's taken us more than 10 years because we're not quick as some people, but I definitely didn't quit my day job. This was always a thing I add in addition to, because if you watch Shark Tank, they always want people to quit their job and put their full time into it to show they're motivated. But for me, that would have been the death knell. And why would I quit my job as an airline pilot to make games? But but if you don't have that foundation of ongoing ability to be able to make a living, then it's much more stressful and also puts you in a position where you're going to be more like where you have potential to fail. But it's different because our business, if we had a business where we had to run a restaurant or have a storefront, a lot of things, you have to be there every day. You have to do things every day. Those kind of things, you have to kind of be there or get people you can trust to be there. And so our business luckily didn't have that requirement of having a lot of overhead. We have overhead and inventory, but initially everybody was paid per job they did. Now we have people on salary, but initially it was something we could kind of meter and be patient with. And we didn't have to have the risk of inventory and things like rent and stuff.
So before we wrap up this first section of the podcast interview, I want to ask you, what would you say has been your biggest failure in this endeavor that you guys have gone through and the advice that you would give to game makers who want to break into the industry?
Well, the biggest failure probably is that I didn't do much research before we started this. But part of that, if I'd known more, I may not have done the business, because if I'd realized the risk, it may have kept me from doing it. But so it's a mixed blessing. But if I was going to start this business, I would have been better off to go to this thing called GAMA, which is Game Manufacturing Association. They have a trade show every year. Usually I could have gone there and learned a lot about the business. I could have gone to Toy Fair and just walked the floor and seen what other things were being offered. I could have really been a lot more thorough in preparing for it. So I went into it with a lot of bluster, but not a lot of actual research. And we didn't have a business plan. I was talking to a business consultant guy who works for a community college that a friend of mine knew, you know, before we were profitable. He says, it was kind of a cavalier decision to start this business. I go, we just kind of started it. It kind of just evolved. But definitely the lack of preparation and lack of business knowledge skills. As we started to get successful, we kind of had a difficult time a couple years ago because I didn't really have the tools to lead a team. Once we started to get a team, I didn't have the mindset of having regular meetings, of structuring things, of delegating. I didn't do a very good job as our team grew in delegating and in managing a team working together. So that is, I'm not still not super good at it, but it was definitely a difficult time as I started to go from being just my wife and I and an artist to try and have more people working with us. That was a difficult stage because I wasn't really equipped to manage that. And it was some self-inflicted injuries there, but we stuck with it and worked through it and came out okay. But it was a difficult time.
We are going to talk on that a little bit in our year one section in just a few minutes. But first, I want to wrap up with our lightning round. So just a few of my favorite questions, and I just want to see your thoughts on them. So the first one would be, what is your biggest fear?
I definitely would be afraid if I was going to fail, because I know a lot of people rely on me, you know, and my family. And I think if I failed to be a good example, I think that'd be my biggest fear, because I looked to people around me as part of my support group. And if I was to fail people by not living up to my own standards in life, that would be a fear. But I'm totally resolute that I won't, but I never want to be a bad example to somebody, or to be an example of quitting or not working hard or not being relied upon. I want to be somebody who people can trust to rely on the fact that I'm going to stick with what I've said and be there. So
I love that one. I think that one's a great one. The next question is, what is your personal definition of failure?
Certainly, having a time that something doesn't work out does not make you a failure, because I actually read books and stuff about Abraham Lincoln and other people who had difficult challenges before they succeeded. And so you can't say Abraham Lincoln was a failure because he didn't get elected the first time, or because he had this failure or that. Only failure you have is if you don't get up and get back going on it again. I certainly had failures in my investment choices and options, but those were setbacks and difficulties that helped, that affected my mindset. But if I'd given up and never tried again, that would have been a failure. But because I never give up on people or my potential to someday improve, then I think I'm not going to fail. But if someone fails once and quits, then they failed.
That's a great way to put it. I've never heard it put that way, but I really like that. And then the last one in this section is, what's one habit that you have that has helped contribute to your success?
I make lists. Every day. I make lists infinitely. I mean, I'm always making a list of things to do today or for this project. I'm always working off of a set of goals and a list of activities. And so I'm not the most organized person, but I'm always making a list of what I got to do. And I never get through the whole list, but I'm always on a task basis to get something done. And in my mindset, I have all these little phrases I've used for my whole lifetime as little mottos, like winners never quit and quitters never win. When the going is tough, the tough get going. I have, you know, all these little things that have been part of my mindset that I live by. And so I really, you know, think it's a matter of persistence and never giving up.
Yeah, that is amazing. Thank you again for taking the time to share your story about Grandpa Beck's games and just about some of the failures and the struggles that you guys have gone through to get there, because I know it is not an easy journey at all to find success at any level, let alone being already doing $3.5 million in sales every year, and yet you have the potential for so much more. So it's been a really great conversation that we've had, and I am super excited to jump into the year one section now about how you would go about launching a business again, or tackling the first 12 months after launching a business.
So like you guys just heard, I did another section with Brent Beck about very practical advice for what he would do if he were to restart his business now from scratch. Everything that he would do in the first 12 months to make sure that it would be successful. So it was an additional 32 minutes of content, just really good, down and dirty, straight to the point with everything. And that is something that I am launching on my Patreon page. So if you haven't joined it yet, go to patreon.com/freedomtofail. And on there are a few different pledge levels just to get support. I'm mainly doing this as a way to help fund this podcast, because it costs a little bit of money to keep it up and going every month. So it's not very much. I have a few different tiers, $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month. And anything that you do or put towards it just goes completely to supporting this podcast and helping me provide good quality content. So if you are interested in hearing the year one section, again, go to patreon.com/freedomtofail. You can choose a pledge level, and on there you can get access to this one. Plus, moving forward as well, I'm going to have a lot more year one episodes, as well as a few other additional bonus episodes of Freedom to Fail that you can only get on Patreon. So I just want to say thank you for all the support there. And if you've ever wanted to do something to support me a little bit more, then that is how you can get involved and get some additional value as well. That's especially good if you are planning on starting a business and you want to be able to hear exactly how people who have been successful would do it if they were to restart now. And the last thing that I wanted to plug again is the coupon code to get any of the Grandpa Beck's games from now until November 24th of this year for 15% off. The coupon code is free to fail. So that's free, the number 2, fail. And you can use that on both their Amazon store. You can search Grandpa Beck's Games or else on grandpabecksgames.com. And that's good until November 24th. So take advantage. And until next week, when I bring you another super awesome interview, let's all remember to embrace the fail and just knock it out of the park and go reach our dreams.